Okay, we're recording. Welcome, everyone, to part two of our special series, Hockey Cards 101. I am Josh, joined by Troy. With Troy? I never know which one to say. Troy's here. How's it going?
I'm here. It's going well. I'm excited.
Yeah, so I don't know if we really ever thought we would be in this place in part two of our Hockey Cards 101 series. We had the idea to launch a special podcast series where our goal is to help people that are maybe new to hockey card collecting or have wanted to get into it, but maybe felt intimidated by a lack of knowledge and just need a little bit of confidence to go ahead and jump in. And so we took a little bit of a leap, right, Troy? A couple weeks ago, launched part one of this series, not knowing how people would respond. And in a very pleasant and amazing way, people seem to have really liked it. So here we are, part two.
Yeah, we did. We got lots of positive feedback, which if we got lots of negative feedback, I would have been sad. And I'm not sure if episode two would have happened. But obviously, constructive feedback, always welcome. But I was worried. It'd be like, you guys suck. You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, part two would have been just us under our beds crying. So we're happy to be back for part two. Like we said, it's really meant for new collectors. So, or, you know, even if you're a seasoned collector and you want to refresh or point out what we're wrong or missed, we're happy to have you here as well, too. If you do know somebody that is new to collecting or that might benefit from these episodes, please feel free to recommend and share this special series with them. We do recommend that you start at the beginning. So if you're just jumping in right now, there is sort of a chronological order, right, Troy, that we're trying to apply to this. So start with part one. And I think this next segment or episode will make a lot more sense. All right, let's get rolling. There's a ton of information we want to cover today. So Troy, why don't you start with our overview?
Sure. We are going to start this episode by looking at what we missed in the previous episode. Then we will look at the different types of hockey cards. This will be followed by a discussion of the four factors of card condition. Next, we will look at some ways to protect your cards. And finally, we will end this episode with some ideas on how to exactly store your cards. So obviously, the first thing there is what we missed last time. And we actually had a really good post or a comment from Instagram user Prospector Collector. And he brought up 2 points around the TV deal at Fanatics. And it's kind of funny, Josh, because I think we have mentioned the TV deal like 4 times in the past episodes. And of course, we get to Hockey 101 and we talk about the growth of the hobby. And we totally forgot to bring up, yes, the national TV deal with ESPN and TNT that the NHL signed is definitely helping the hockey card market and the outlook for it. Obviously, the games now are on national TV. You don't have to hunt and peck, like Josh has said, the outdoor hunting, fishing channel, trying to find a hockey game in the U.S. at least. Now they're ESPN and TNT and sometimes ABC now have the games, which definitely leads to more exposure. And then the second comment, obviously, yes, with Fanatics entering the sports card market and the marketing power, especially that they bring to market sports cards, even if it's not direct, they don't have hockey, obviously Upper Deck does, but with their power, their marketing and just growing the hobby, that I think they will help even push like the rising tides lift all seas kind of approach. Now, I will say Fanatics has kind of stumbled a little bit in the last, you know, month or two, but you can't deny how big that company is and the success that they've had in the past.
For everyone's reference, again, Fanatics is the major supplier of sports jerseys that you would see at a stadium, or if you go on to your favorite team's website, they're typically manufacturing and fulfilling those. They bought the licenses in the past year for basketball, football, and baseball, and also bought Topps and are rumored to buy Panini. So they're going to be a huge force in the sports card market. They don't have the hockey license, though. That's held by Upper Deck. Okay, great recap. Thank you to Prospector Collector for chiming in. Definitely keep doing that, guys. Let us know anything that we forgot so we can bring that up when we get to the point where we release part three. What's hard about this episode, where we want to talk about cards and really everything about hockey cards, Troy, is where to start.
Yeah.
that took a little bit. And so I think we've come up with a pretty good way to introduce the concept of the cards, talk about them in a logical order. Where I wanted to start was with licensed and unlicensed. And that's not something that I really learned about until probably 6 months into collecting. And it ended up being a really big deal. And I remember thinking, Troy, why wasn't there information on this before? And so, because it does affect the value of cards actually pretty greatly. And so, again, I thought it was a great place to start. So licensed cards means that the manufacturer, the company that makes the cards, has an agreement with both, in the case of hockey, the NHL and the NHL Players Association to not only, so we'll start with the NHLPA, to use the name and likeness of the player. So Connor McDavid, his name and a picture of him, his face, right? And then have a separate deal with the league. So in this case, the NHL, to use all the trademarks of that the league holds. So the name of the team, so the Edmonton Oilers, using McDavid as our example, their logo, and really give you a complete representation of the card. So Upper Deck, as we said, owns the license for hockey. So they're the only company today that can produce a hockey card of Connor McDavid that shows his name, his picture of him in an Edmonton Oilers jersey, and a card that has Edmonton Oilers and any other trademark that the NHL has. There are other companies, though, that do produce cards, and they produce what are called unlicensed cards. They still have to have a deal with the player. They could go to that person directly, or I don't know if they can do the Players Association. I don't think that really matters as much. But they can produce a card for Connor McDavid that would only show be his name and likeness, right? So it would have the name on the card, have maybe a picture of his face, and then very genericized beyond that. So a lot of times you'll see unlicensed cards of a player in like a white uniform with, it kind of looks a little weird, and I think, at least personally. Yeah. Or you'll have cards that'll be maybe more like a company called Leaf makes these that are a little more memorabilia focused, where they'll just show a picture of the head in a blank helmet of the player, have their name, and then maybe an autograph, and really try to minimize the negative impact of not having the license. But in addition, so in those cases, I guess, in addition to not to being able to show the logo, they have to say like Connor McDavid Edmonton. They couldn't say Connor McDavid Edmonton Oilers. So there's a big difference in how those cards are valued in the market. Typically a card without licensing is going to limit the desirability of that card. There's going to be licensing snobs, I don't know if there's a better way to put that, that would not have interest in that card because it doesn't contain the licensing.
I look at it this way. If there's going to be people that hate unlicensed cards, and I don't think there's anyone that hates licensed cards. Sure. So there's no one out there looking for unlicensed cards. So I think that's, you know, to me is where you're going to get the decrease in value. Less people want an unlicensed card.
Perfect. Yeah. And so we said Upper Deck currently has the license for hockey. They renewed it in 2021. So they'll have it for a while. In addition to doing a license with the league or deal with the league, manufacturers can also make deals with particular players. So Upper Deck, and ironically, also has the deal with Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan, LeBron James, I believe Tiger Woods, for exclusive autographs. While Upper Deck cannot produce a basketball card because they don't have the license that has the LeBron James in a LA Lakers uniform, they're the only company that can produce a basketball card of LeBron James that's autographed.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah. It gets really complicated when you start looking at deals, and then some of these guys will sign deals only for memorabilia that they can do. It gets really into the weeds if you want to look into licensing agreements.
We don't need to go that far into it, but I think it's important for people right off the bat when you're understanding hockey cards to, like I said, I wish I had known that earlier in my collecting experience. You don't see it too often in hockey because Upper Deck has such a dominance, but if you're buying other products like Leaf and they make some fine sets with some cool cards, but you just got to know what the difference between cards that are unlicensed versus cards that are licensed. The next way that we thought to really break down hockey cards was to go by player type. So you'll see typically there's really kind of four types of people or players or personalities that have cards. There's a rookie card, and that might seem really simple, but in the case of hockey or in even some other sports, it's actually not as simple as you might think.
Yeah, there's rules around it, and we're not going to get into all the rules, but there's definitely some weirdness around it.
I think the best way to think of a rookie card, it's the first set year, right? And so, like, if you think of all the different types of hockey cards that Upper Deck is going to make for the 2021 or 2022 now, 23 season, it's the first year that the player appears in those cards.
Right? In the NHL, like, jersey logo.
In the NHL licensed jersey.
Yeah.
The important part is it's not necessarily the first year they play in the NHL.
Yep.
There's also some like weird cases where you'll have true rookie cards that actually do appear in multiple years of multiple. I don't know. Is there a better way to put that where you talk about like all the 2022, 23 Upper Deck cards versus the 2021, 22 set year seems
set years.
Probably to me what makes the most sense. There are some rare exceptions like Michael Bunting, who is a really old, coincidentally, but, you know, rookie that played for Arizona and then was traded to the Maple Leafs. So his Young Guns rookie appeared in the 2020-21 Upper Deck extended set, which comes out at the end of the season. And he was in the Coyotes uniform. He was then traded to Toronto. And the best that I can figure, Troy, is that Upper Deck wanted to capitalize on him going to one of the premier teams in the NHL. And they included a Young Guns canvas version, so a parallel of that, or in the next year, so 2021-22 hockey set. So there are some rare exceptions, but generally it's when Upper Deck feels like they have enough service time or enough games played in the NHL that they'll include it in that year's set. So that's rookies. Then there's veterans, which is pretty straightforward. These are players who have been established in the league, are currently active. So in the case of today, it would be like an Austin Matthews or Connor McDavid or Carey Price or some other player like that. The next category would be legends. These cards are becoming pretty popular, and we're seeing, I think, almost more and more of them each year. So these are players like a Bobby Orr, who hasn't played, obviously, in the NHL for many, many years at this point, but they're producing cards in current modern sets for legendary players. I think the reason why manufacturers like Upper Deck do this, Troy, is because it helps them build out bigger sets to keep up with the growth and demand in the hockey card hobby. And it also helps introduce young people to the legends of the game that appeared a long time ago. And I think my third point on that would be for a guy like Orr, who the cards were pretty straightforward 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
Yep.
Now we have these new modern cards that have patches and autos, and it allows to get some of these kind of really cool, intricate cards for these legendary players.
Yeah, and we've talked about it on the podcast. I actually really like those cards. I'm going to make one correction, I think, on your Michael Bunting example. When you talked about the Young Gun canvas, I believe you said it's a parallel. It's actually an insert. So I just want to make sure people don't call us out on that. We'll get into what those mean later, but just a quick correction.
Yeah, actually, that thought crossed my mind when I said it, so I'm glad you looked it up.
The only reason I know that is because I've stared at the checklist for so long the past 3 weeks, rearranging my cards and trying to get everything in the right section, that it just jumped out.
Good to know. The last category is somewhat rare, but we'll see often or sometimes that there'll be cards created for different personalities. Actually, right now, probably the best example is we're seeing a lot of mascot cards.
Yep.
One of the more popular ones would be Gritty from Who's the Mascot for the Philadelphia Flyers. There's Young Guns canvas cards that came out, just canvas cards, mascot, not Young Guns.
Yeah.
In Extended that were real popular. You've also from time to time in certain sets, like a, maybe like a Goodwin's Champions, we'll see different TV personalities that they'll, or writers, somebody connected with the game that they'll do a card, but those are pretty rare. So by player, we have rookie, veteran, legend, and then personality slash mascot. Did I forget anyone?
I don't think so. That's pretty, that covers probably 99% of the cards. I'm sure there's like that 1% that's in some way off realm that we don't even know about.
Okay, so the next way that we thought to look at cards is by, and I don't know, Troy, if this is the best way to put this either, but the what I could come up with was by set configuration. So we've looked at licensed versus unlicensed, by player type, rookie, veteran, legend, personality, and now it's the different types of cards that you would see within a set that all these different personalities could fit into.
Yep.
And the first is, we'll start with, is a base card, or also called a common in a lot of cases. So this is the most common version of a card. It's the version of a player's card that has the highest print run, or the most of that card is produced. Like I said, it can include veterans, legends. You'll see all-star cards that are typically in this, or rookies. And so when a rookie in a base card, you'll often, we go through a lot of key terms, or we want to as part of the series, you'll often find that referred to as a base rookie, right? It'll be the lowest, most common version of that player's rookie card.
Yeah. And just thinking about base cards, if you ever open a pack of cards or a box of cards, the stack you end up with the most cards of is going to be your base cards. It's just, they're the most prevalent usually in a set. Or they are the most prevalent.
Typically have little to no value, but you never know.
Unless they're base rookies.
Yes. And of a player that is maybe nondescript today, but 10 years from now could be a legendary player. It has happened plenty of times where not every rookie comes into the league highly touted and is the number one overall pick that ends up having an amazing career.
Yeah, and even definitely, like Hall of Famers, their second-year base cards can have some value, too. It's not that they're all worthless. It's just most of the time, they're not worth anything. They're good. That's just kind of how the thought is, but there's obviously exceptions to that rule.
A good one would be the 2016 Upper Deck Connor McDavid. I think graded a gem mint goes for around $150, something like that, $100 to $150. Okay, so the next card type by set configuration we wanted to look at was rookie card. We talked about what a rookie is a little bit. The rookie cards are normally designated. So from where hockey is a little bit unique from other sports is hockey has a very well known and valued brand around rookies called Young Guns, which even the most novice collectors have typically heard of. Those are found within the Upper Deck, what we call, and we'll get more into the brands in subsequent episodes in this series, but and what are called like the Upper Deck flagship products. So every year they come out with three flagships, Series 1, Series 2, and extended sort of the beginning, middle, and end of the season. And they'll have the Young Guns branding on those cards. In all of Upper Deck's other sets, though, they will produce plenty of rookies. Those are always the biggest chases, and they're usually designated somehow. Sometimes you'll see like an RC, which stands for rookie card, logo in the corner. Upper Deck owns the Canadian brand OPG, and they have a legacy and a brand around their rookies called a marquee rookies. So you'll see that in OPG cards. Anything else I'm forgetting from a rookie designation perspective?
No, I mean, usually, or they'll just, some cards might just have the term rookies on it. You know, like you gave the example of OPG, but some other like insert might just say rookie. It's one of the, and we kind of talked about this a little bit before, it's one of the things that really, it bothers me a little bit about hockey. Obviously, Young Guns, I get that's the flagship. I know that's a rookie, but when you get into everything else, it's not like baseball where they always have that RC badge that's always on a rookie card. It's usually the same badge on every rookie card. These are a little more, it might say it in a word. It might have an RC logo. It might be a different RC logo on a different card, but usually some way it says rookie card on it. Now, one, mm-hmm. I don't even want to get into that point. Just let's keep going. I don't want to confuse everything too much.
So the next category of cards is kind of a big one. And I put it under short print runs.
Yeah.
And so I think to start, you'll hear people call SP, right? If it's an SP, that stands for short print run. And really, print run means the total numbers of a specific card that are produced in a set, right? Typically, this number is unknown. None of the manufacturers disclose it, but they will designate specific cards in a set as either SP, having a shorter print run, so less cards than all the other base cards in that set, or an SSP, which stands for super short print run. In the case of SSP, those are really typically ultra rare. There's very little of these cards produced. But again, typically the total amount printed or produced is not disclosed by the manufacturer.
Yeah, they might on the back of a box, they might tell you it's one in so many thousand packs. Maybe they don't on some of these, but a lot of times they have to put the odds, I think, on the back of the box of pulling cards. But again, you won't know the end print run number. You just know like one out of so many packs.
Yeah, and a good note here is that, right, scarcity drives value in the hobby. And so when a card is known as a short print or a super short print, those cards will typically be more sought after. There's a couple ways that card manufacturers will, not just hockey, will produce these. Sometimes they might take rookies that are very well, have a lot of hype, very well known, and just produce less of them than would typically be produced. Like actually, Young Guns is a decent example of this. All the 50 rookies that appear in every flagship release are typically one in every four packs, right? So they're much less common than a base card would be. The other way that manufacturers will create scarcity and do shorter print runs on cards is they'll have serial number cards.
Yeah.
So these are where you'll get to open a pack of cards and it'll be numbered 2 out of 99 or 3 out of 6 or 234 out of 499, right? And so the second number tells you how many exact amount of cards that are in existence for that specific card. And the first one tells you which of the serial numbers that you have. The lower number of total cards that are produced will typically have higher value. So if the card's out of 10, it's going to have a higher value than maybe a parallel or same version of that card that maybe is a different color, but is out of 99, right? That's pretty much common sense. There are a couple examples, Troy, of serial numbers that do have increased value that are just kind of, I don't know, unique to the hobby, or you might not be able to tell right away. So whether the card is out of 10 or 99 or 1,000, if you are able to buy or pull out of a pack one out of whatever it's out of, so one out of 99, one out of 10, one out of 999, you'll see a little bit of premium typically for that card. Where you'll see even a little bit bigger bump is on the jersey number.
Yeah.
So if I'm a Kirill Kaprizov fan and I know his number's out of 97 and I pull a 97 out of 99, there's going to be, and I don't know exactly what the multiplier is. I've heard 15, 20%. You'd have to kind of look on an individual case.
Yeah.
But the 97 out of 99 is going to have more value than the 96 out of 99 or the 20 out of 99 because it matches that player's jersey number. And it kind of gets us down to the one of one, which will typically kind of gets you into the category of the most valuable type of hockey card. So if you're lucky enough to ever own or pull out of a pack a one of one, it means exactly that it's the one version of that card that was ever produced. So it's the most scarce version of that card. Last thing I'll mention on serial numbers, and this kind of is a good segue into our next topic, parallels, but serial number cards are often parallels, which simply means that you'll have the same version of a card that you'll have a version of a card that's maybe got a blue accent color that's out of 99. There might be a red that's out of 199 or a yellow out of 59. And if people talk about collecting the rainbow, now, if you ever hear that term, it's trying to get one card from every one of the different levels of serial numbers. I don't know, Troy, if that's the best way to put it.
But
or each parallel maybe, but we'll get into parallels next. One point I'm going to make on a term, if you ever hear the term bookend, it basically means if the cards, let's say it's out of 99, serial numbered out of 99, if you get number one or number 99, they call it a bookend. You just might hear the term. I don't think it means much besides the one having a little more value, but obviously there's no premium to having the 99 bookend out of 99. It's just a term you might hear. And if you didn't know what it means, that's what it means.
Sure.
That's a great segue into parallels. So really what I think of a parallel, Troy, it's a shorter print run version of a base card. So it'll still have the same basic card design and normally the image. Where you'll see a difference is maybe an accent color, or it'll have a serial number with it to give it a little bit of differentiation, but so you know that it's just a different version or a more scarce version of the base card. Anything else on parallels? I mean, it seems pretty straightforward.
Oh, and the thing too with parallels, if you ever need to like look at them, we'll get in this later too. You can go online to find parallels of sets. We'll talk about in another episode where you can go to find all this stuff, but it's a really simple concept and the parallels, but there's a lot of different parallels that can happen on a card.
And that brings us now into inserts. And so let's go back to our Young Guns canvas, right? Yep. Where I mistook it as a parallel. It's really an insert. Inserts are, I guess I define those as they're unique cards, normally with a shorter print run than the base cards that are added to a set or a base set as part of the set. So when you open up a pack and you have, let's say, of hockey cards, and you have a whole bunch of like common or base cards, and then you'll see like a net deposits or a portrait card in there, or there's a million types that look totally different and maybe shinier or just have a different design or have a theme to them around the city that the player plays for. These are insert cards. What's important to know about inserts is that there's some inserts that are incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
So in the hockey world right now, some of those valuable cards there are precious metal gems or PMGs. Or you go back a few years ago to cards that are jambalaya or essential credential cards. These cards can go for $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $100,000 and up. And then there's inserts that Upper Deck will put into packs that are worth 10 cents too. Yep. So it just because it's an insert does not mean it's valuable. It comes down to how intricate the card is, what the collector or the hobby thinks of those cards. You know, hype drives a lot of the value, and then ultimately how common they are too. Some inserts are very common, and others are pretty rare.
And then just to add more confusion to everything, an insert card can't have a parallel. So there are parallels of insert cards. So just
sure. A great example would be the holographics insert of Upper Deck.
Yep.
There's a standard silver version, and then there's a shorter print run gold version.
Yep.
That's a fantastic point, Troy. Okay, so we've covered base cards, rookie cards, short prints, parallels, inserts. The next segment of cards that can be again in all these classes too, but is really important in the sports card collecting world are autos, for I think obvious reasons, because there's not what's more cooler than having the autograph of one of your favorite players. And you know, we'll probably spend a little bit of time on this because it does get a little bit detailed and I guess intricate in some ways. The first type of auto is either an in-person signed card or a hand signed card. So the best way to think about this is you take a hockey card that was produced not intended to have an autograph, and you have that card in your possession, and you go to an event or you go to a game and you present it to your favorite player, and they use a marker and they autograph that card. Great example is Troy and I are going to go to one of the big, the biggest hockey card show, the Sports Card Expo in November in Toronto. Dominic Hasek is going to be there. You can pay him like 50 or 60 bucks and take your favorite Dominic Hasek card and put it down on the table, and he'll take a marker and sign it. And now you have a signed Dominic Hasek card. These can be really tricky though, Troy, especially on the buying end, because so many of these cards are faked.
Yep.
The reason being, of course, is that a regular Dominic Hasek card that's not graded, or we'll call it raw, could be $3, an autographed version someone might pay $75 for. Yeah. So there's an infinite amount of people that will go buy Sharpies and try to learn by mimicking somebody's autograph and signing it. And so you're really essentially taking a leap of faith that if you buy without provenance or without authentication, that this autograph is legitimate that you're purchasing. Now, you might have a card that you go to the Sports Card Expo and get signed, or you went to a game, or you have a family friend. Well, if you know it's real and you're collecting it forever, who cares?
Yeah.
But if you're buying, you want to buy cards that are autographed in this manner, or you want to try to sell them, it does create, you have to prove that this is a legitimate autograph. And really the other thing I'll add to this to dial up the complexity, maybe a little bit more, not only are there a ton of fake autographs, there's tons of fake autograph authentication companies to go with. So you really have to understand where this autograph came from and who's authenticating it to have total confidence that it's legitimate. And typically what the hobby does, and we'll have a whole episode on grading companies, but one thing grading companies do in addition to grading the condition of cards is they also authenticate autographs. And so the hobby has decided that really the big leading companies like PSA or Beckett or SGC or CSG, that if they authenticate the autographs, that you can be generally assured that that autograph is real.
Yeah, I'll just add my 2 cents. I don't want to scare people away, but I would stay away from autograph cards that I couldn't get some kind of authentication on, because it's a big business, the fakes. And in the U.S. here, the FBI, it seems every 4 to 5 years, busts some huge ring. It's not to scare people away, but just if you really want an autograph, make sure you're doing your homework to make sure it's real, or get it yourself in person.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, so there is a much safer version of auto cards that you can purchase and enjoy and definitely collect. And those are, I guess, what I'm terming as card manufacturer authenticated autos. So these are autographs that are intended to be on cards that are guaranteed by so Upper Deck in the case of hockey cards, or Leaf if you buy those cards too, or there's other sets that, and what you're typically counting on as a collector is that company has verified either that was there when the player signed them, or is kind of putting their brand behind the legitimacy of those autographs. Where you'll see that authentication is normally on the back of the card.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at a card and you can't even maybe tell if this was signed, a hand signed by a player after the card was produced, or was originally intended to be part of the card, look at the back. And if it is part of the card design, it'll have the authenticity statement by the manufacturer.
Yeah.
There. Okay. So on these manufacturer autos, there's a number of different types of autos that appear on cards. And this is really important to know, because it has, a big impact within the hobby too. So the first one we'll talk about are hard signed. So this is where the player takes their marker and signs their autograph directly onto the cardboard or chromium or whatever the card is made out of on that card. Pretty straightforward there. What you see a lot of, though, in these cards are what are generally referred to as label or sticker autos. So in those cases, the player is either gets presented to by a representative for the card manufacturer, mailed, I'm not sure how they do it, a sheet of labels that are essentially stickers, and they'll autograph, you know, maybe it'll have 50 stickers on a page, and they'll sit and write their name 600 times or sign their name. And then the card manufacturer, like Upper Deck, can take those sheets and take a sticker off and place it on a card and manufacture cards that way. From a desirability and value perspective, the hobby is generally pretty clear that they prefer hard signed autographs. So autographs directly onto the cards over the label or sticker autos. And the reason why, so you might ask, well, if everyone likes hard signed cards, why do card companies use sticker autos? There's it's based really around logistics. Athletes can be fickle. They're busy. There's in times like COVID, it's hard to get a representative and lug 300 cards for them to sign. So it's much easier to get a sheet of paper signed with a bunch of signatures. And, you know, it allows these companies to produce more autograph cards. Anything else on that, Trey?
No, that's all I would say about label or sticker autos and hard signed autos.
There's actually one more type of autograph card that you will run into. Not a lot, but it's called a cut auto. You'll typically see these for legendary players or figures that typically passed away a long time ago, where because of that, of course, they're not able to produce more autographs for the sports card industry to use. And so what card manufacturers will do is they'll take like a document or a check or anything, a postcard, anything that person had signed, and like the name, cut it out and put it onto a sports card. Yep. And there are actually some, it kind of seems weird when you think about it at first, but there are some cards that we've seen that are pretty cool, like some old Lord Stanley cards, who obviously passed away long time ago, and will have different cut auto cards. But it's important to know what that term is. And then the last one is, it's not, I guess, a unique category, but did want to mention, because it's a term you're going to hear over and over again in the hobby, is rookie autos. So these are rookie cards that are designated rookie cards, but also include a player's auto. Typically, again, you'll see the difference in value here between hard signed and label. The hard signed will be more desirable. Okay. Any notes on autos, Troy?
Nope. Autos sound good. They make sense. I will say on cut autos, I thought they were kind of dumb. But then when you looked at those, you see those older ones, and like the Lord Stanley, or even seeing like a Babe Ruth cut auto card, those are pretty cool. I like those. There are some that are kind of ridiculous at times, but when you get checks that are more recent, you can see the numbering on the check is just kind of odd. But.
Yeah, Babe Ruth's bank account number. well, and two, what I think those cut autos, what really makes them is when you see the aging of the paper.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. It just makes it feel really old. And I think that's pretty cool. Okay. So the next card configuration is a big one too, and it's memorabilia. So here's a big catch-all that will go through all the different types. So from a definition standpoint, I really consider it a card that includes an element of a uniform or equipment that enhances the design and or collectability of that card. Is that a good definition?
Yep.
So there's tons of different types of memorabilia. The most common would be a jersey swatch. So this is a small cutout of a player's jersey that gets embedded into the card. These cards will be a little bit thicker, typically, than a normal card. It's usually a single color, but can be multiple colors depending on that player's jersey. Not super desirable. It beats a base card for sure, but there is a little bit of a negative connotation around the hobby around these cards, especially if you get a card that has like a pure white or a solid color of that jersey. The colloquial or way that you'll hear that is if you hear the term napkin patch, that's what it means. It's a little bit of a derogatory term towards that type of card. Not trying to talk too bad about it, but that's just how the hobby looks at it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, because you're going to talk about the next category, which relates to the same thing. But when we say jersey swatches, it's like a colored piece of the jersey. It's not the logo or the patch, which is coming up next. So just, they're kind of simplistic, and that's how they are. The next category, though, is very desirable.
Yeah, that would be patches. So that's a cutout or piece of a patch from that player's jersey. Now, the big thing to keep in mind here is that not all patches are created equal.
Yep.
Right? So multicolored patches will have greater desirability and value. The more colors, typically, the more value. And Troy, I think this is a huge advantage for hockey card collecting in particular.
Yes.
Because hockey jerseys or sweaters have the best patches of any sport.
Yeah, they're the best looking uniforms of any sport by far.
My classic example is the Blackhawks jersey, and you look at patches from that can have four or five colors easily in them, and it just look amazing. So the size of the patch and what part of the design within the patch that displays really also matters from a desirability and value perspective too. Right? If you can make out part of the logo for that team, that's going to enhance the value. So there could be a set of parallels that are patch or even inserts that maybe are out of 50. And one of those 50, it could be number 23 out of 50, will have the best version of that patch. That card would have the highest value. It's subjective, of course, but you'll see trying to people that, you know, will try to sell for a premium because of that.
Yeah.
Okay, just like with rookie autos, there's rookie patches. So that, you know, simply means a jersey swatch or patch on a rookie card. It will typically enhance the value over just a plain old rookie card, especially if it's a nice multicolored patch that is serial number 2. And that kind of brings us now into a little bit of a culmination where we talk about another key term that is not super obvious when you start in the hobby, but you hear all the time, the term RPA. So that stands for Rookie Patch Auto. So it's a card that has, that's a rookie card. It's designated as a rookie card. It includes a patch on the low end, maybe a napkin jersey swatch patch that we talked about. On the high end, a big, beautiful patch of the logo that has multicolors, and then also a autograph of that player. Again, on the low end, the autograph might be a label or sticker auto, and on the high end, it would be a hard signed on the card. Now we're talking about really some of the most desirable cards that there is. And probably the best example of this, if you want to think what's the highest and highest case of a rookie patch auto, within the cup set that the Upper Deck produced, there's a subset of cards that are called the Exquisite Collection. Every year they will have the NHL Shield patch auto. So it's the NHL shield from the player's jersey, the whole shield intact. It'll be autographed and hard signed by the player. It's always a one of one. So we talked about serial number, and it's the only card that's produced. So if you're looking at a Connor McDavid or Sidney Crosby or Cale Makar or Kirill Kaprizov, this would be really the highest value hockey card in existence for that player, you know, from a modern hockey perspective. There's also some other types of memorabilia cards too that are actually becoming more popular, but are still not super common, I guess. And I think you already brought this up, there's laundry tags.
Yep.
Which is always kind of funny to think about. And it really just shows a piece of the laundry tag from the inside of the jersey.
Yep.
That it's usually a better part of, you know, the tag that
it might say shows like Adidas or Nike or whatever.
Yeah, Team Canada or something like that. These are often found on more premium cards that have real low serial numbers. And you'll often find them, too, on cards in conjunction with other types of memorabilia. So you'll have cards that are maybe four or quad patch or double patch that'll have a nice patch in one panel and then a laundry tag in another panel. Another type of memorabilia trade that we'll often see are fight straps,
yep,
which is a fancy kind of marketing spin on the chin strap. I don't remember this is a little bit of a newer phenomenon. I could be totally wrong here, but I think within the last 10 years at least that cards typically will have those.
When you look at them, they do look like chin straps. I wonder if they do include, they must include a fight strap card. Because on the back of their jerseys, obviously they have fight straps that connect to their breezers so they don't get jerseyed. Or I don't even know if you can, I think that might be I can't remember if they got that, if they made that a penalty now, if you jersey someone. Like pull their jersey over their head and they start wailing on them. So maybe there's no need for them anymore.
Yeah, it has like the button.
Yeah,
that's why it would be like a chin strap.
Like a button.
But yeah, those are pretty desirable. Again, often found in the more premium, lower numbered cards. A couple other ones that you'll see now and again are sticks. So maybe like a shaving off the player's stick. In some cases where those will be in conjunction with an autograph where the player will actually sign the part of the stick. And then you'll also see some cards that'll have pucks. So again, shaving of the puck where you'll, just like with sticks, you'll sometimes see the autograph on the puck too.
Yeah, there's been recently I saw some goalie pad cards were in stature. The new stature released by Upper Deck had goalie pad pieces.
Oh, nice. What I would say, though, is when you look from a value perspective and looking at patches and autographs, unless the card has a real big patch that's multicolored and shows a identifiable and cool part of the logo, typically they're not as valuable unless they have that second component of the autograph as well. And this is for not only rookies, but for veterans and legends too. It's the combination of the autograph and the memorabilia yeah. that really creates the big time value for a lot of these cards. Another type of card that is not super common, but often very valuable are booklets. I don't actually own a booklet. Do you, Troy? Oh, yeah, I think you do.
I have. No, I don't. I don't think
I had a Pecorine booklet.
No, I bid on one that I got beat out on.
Okay. So these are, if you think of two cards that are binded together and collapse like a book, that would be a booklet. Many times these will have real big patches or other types of memorabilia and be autographs. So they're taking advantage of the extra real estate you get by essentially binding two cards together. From like a we'll get into protecting cards in a minute. The one, I guess, drawback on booklets is that they're hard to encapsulate a lot of times and great because they're big, right?
Yeah, especially the big ones.
They become a little hard to protect without damaging, but they're super cool and people go crazy for them.
Yeah, I mean, you can get, like Josh kind of said, there's ones that are like eight card long booklets of autographs, and there's some pretty amazing ones out there.
Another subset of cards is to that kind of ties in both autographs typically and memorabilia are there's multiple player cards. A great example of this is when Sidney Crosby was a rookie, you saw a lot of like Crosby and Lemieux cards together, or you'll see a subset of legends, maybe like Wayne Gretzky, Gordie Howe, Bobby Orr, all sign a card. Maybe they'll just be autographed. Maybe they'll have memorabilia. They're typically, though, have at least one of the two. You don't often see a card that has multiple players on it that doesn't include at least autographs or memorabilia. So wanted to definitely note that. When it comes to memorabilia, though, Troy, I think there's a whole other element of this that's really important for people yep. to understand, and it's how the memorabilia is sourced matters a lot
yep.
when it comes to the value of cards. And it's really important to understand that. The first thing I'll say is that, again, just like with the autograph authentication, how the type of memorabilia and how that memorabilia was procured, I guess, for lack of a better term, will be on the back of the card as well. So there's four categories that I have typically seen. And the first is the least desirable, and it's manufactured. So this could be a jersey swatch or a sweater or patch that the player never wore or touched or ever had any involvement in. And the card manufacturer had a bunch of patches made so that they could put them into cards.
Yep.
Again, these are typically the least desirable because they're not connected to that player in a meaningful way.
Yeah. They're like artificial or something. I don't like them at all. Yeah. And the more I see them, the more I don't like them, but they serve a purpose. There's probably are some people that like them. They can fit a whole, like the Blackhawks logo, they can fit the whole thing on the card then if they shrink it down into that manufactured yep. patch, which is kind of cool, but yeah.
Then there's player worn or used. So, and this is kind of funny when you think about it, is what manufacturers will do, essentially to say that a player wore a jersey, is they'll get them in a room, they'll have 30 jerseys, and they'll have them literally put it on, count to two, take it off,
yep.
and then, right, it meets the technical definition of player worn. And yes, they do this,
mm-hmm.
right? Because then on the back of the card, it says player worn. So it's more desirable than having a manufactured patch that didn't have any connection to the player, but it's more, you know, it comes down to me like if you've ever talked about like the difference between the spirit of the law and the letter of the law, it kind of meets the letter of the law, but not necessarily lives up to the spirit of, you know, what you'd hope in that card. But there are a number of cards that are produced in that manner. The next one would be event worn. So a good example of this would be, let's say it's the All-Star Game Skills Competition where the NHL produces special jerseys. And a player will wear that jersey during that event. Then they'll cut out swatches or patches from that and produce those in All-Star cards, right? So it's a little, going back to the spirit of what we want to see in these cards, it's a little more connected to that player than maybe a player-worn card. but not fully used in like the most desirable, which we'll talk about next, which is game worn. Right. So if you get a card that has a jersey swatch or a patch, more preferably, then on the back it says this is game worn and particularly has the date of that game, that would be the highest desirability and the highest value of cards. And there are some like really valuable, very low numbered, limited cards that are produced in this manner that are Upper Deck might produce a special set of cards or inserts for the, that include like Stanley Cup worn jerseys. And obviously people go crazy over those, Troy. Okay, so that was kind of a lot, but hopefully it gives everyone a really good understanding of what the types of cards are, from licensed to unlicensed, to the different types of players that can appear, and all the different variations of cards that can exist. All right, Troy. So next, I think we need to roll into condition. This is another one of those daunting topics. So in sports card collecting, it's a critical factor as to how cards are bought, sold, traded, and really valued. If you think about how a sports card or hockey card is valued, to me, it comes down to three core elements. It's the desirability of that player, or scarcity of the card, and then the condition that that card is in. There's a huge element of condition that comes down to grading, and we're going to have probably an entire episode of this series on grading alone, so I don't want to go too far into that today, but cards are made out of cardboard, so they can be easily damaged or dented or creased or scuffed or scratched, and that's going to lower the appeal of the card and lower the ultimately the desirability and value of it, and obviously have a huge impact, like I said, on the value. So a great example of this is the Wayne Gretzky. Most people have heard of that guy. You heard of him, right, Troy?
He scored some goals, I think.
Scored a few goals. So his rookie, of course, is a 1979. There's two versions, but the most sought after is the OPG. 8,200 of those have been sent in for grading to probably the leading grading card company today, PSA. And Troy, only two have received the highest grade. So it'd be a PSA 10 Gem Mint out of the thousands that have been submitted. And that's why the card has most recently sold for more than $3.5 million, because the amount of cards that receive that highest grade is very, very small. Again, we'll talk more about grading card companies in the future, but essentially they all use sort of the same grading scale, and it starts at poor. So that would be a beat up, dented, creased, mangled car would typically
have in the bicycle spokes.
Yes, it'll have, and it goes from fair to good to very good to excellent, near mint, mint, gem mint, and pristine. And there's a couple grades in between that. So your highest graded, your perfect cards would be considered either a gem mint or pristine by graders. So the important thing here is, how do these guys determine, or these companies, or me as a collector, if I'm looking at a card, what are the factors I should be looking at to determine the level of condition that any hockey card is in? And there's really four factors that determine what the condition or grade of that is. It's corners, edges, surface, and centering. So we'll start with corners. Pretty obvious. It's cards are rectangular. They have four corners.
Most are rectangular.
Yes, there are some that are rounded. That's right. You're very true. Like a jambalaya, right, would be a good example of one.
Yeah, just we'll throw out a term. They're usually called die cuts.
Die cuts, yes. I left that out. Forgot die
cuts.
There
it is.
And,
well, at least we caught it.
Yeah, so die cuts are cards that are not the standard rectangular shape, that have either punch outs or have an intricate design and are typically a pain to store. we'll get into that in a minute, or get into the top loaders or penny sleeves. So when it comes to corners, are the corners typically, if they're rectangular, sharp? Do they not show any bends or dents or wear? On a lot of older cards, or like vintage cards in particular, you'll find like fuzzy corners, right? Yeah. Where there's a little bit of fraying in them, but they should be very sharp, not dented.
It should make that 90-degree angle. You know, you'll see some vintage cards mostly have rounded edges sometimes, depending on how they're stored and taken care of or just the material they're on.
Next category is edges. So are the edges of the card clean? Are they sharp? Where they don't show any signs of trimming, so people have tried to make the edges better by taking a scissors or cut them. In modern cards, they want to be very clean and sharp. Ironically, though, Troy, for some vintage cards, like the one we just talked about, the 1979 OPG Gretzky, those cards were not cut by shears or blades. They're actually cut by wire, so I think a piano wire. And so you'd want to see a little bit of fraying on those, because that's the original representation of how that card was cut. Moving on, so we have corners, we have edges. The next one is surface. So is the surface of the card, both front and back, is it free of scratches, creases, print marks, print lines, or smudges and stains? Did I forget anything there?
No, I think that's most of them. And you'll probably in your journey as you collect, you will hit every one of these at some point.
The next one and last one is centering. So is the card centered? And this seems straightforward, but it's kind of not, like a lot of things in the hobby. Whether the card is centered is easiest to tell on cards that have borders. So sometimes the cards have like a white border around it. And centering is measured from both left to right and top to bottom. And it needs to be equal amounts of space on the border on each side. Cards, though, that don't have borders are still measured from a centering perspective. How? I guess I don't know. You know, but Upper Deck has, or the grading companies have some way of measuring if the card was centered. And this accounts, again, it's important to note, just like with surface, centering is measured for both the front and the back of the card. One point that is really important to understand about condition and is completely counterintuitive, Troy. Like, I would have never guessed this in a million years when I got into the hobby, that actually a very low percentage of cards right off the printing press are in what would be considered gem mint condition.
And I think that's a huge, huge misunderstanding by news people. I think new people into the hobby, probably me when I started out, thought, well, this thing came right off the press into the pack. It should be almost perfect. And no. You will learn really quick just the stuff that can not go wrong, but the issues that some of these cards have right out of the box.
Yeah, you'll see on eBay listings where people will mark them as pack fresh, right? And that they're trying to communicate to you that, hey, I took this card, right? I opened a pack, I took a picture of it, and I put it up on eBay, right? So it should be in better condition than you would expect had it sat around my house for a long time. Now, almost all of these different ways, from edges to corners to surface and centering, cards can be completely messed up coming out of the pack.
Yep.
You can have dented corners from the shipping of the cards at the pack, or from how they were packed. You can have print lines or print marks or nicks on the surface of the card. An edge can be smashed in. Very often cards are, even today, are not centered. Off the printing press. So don't assume that any card you buy at the store or pull out of a new box is going to have that ability to be considered a gem mint condition. Another key term that I don't know if this is the best spot to throw this in, but we kind of have to mention it at some point, is the term raw card. So a raw card is a card that's not graded and encapsulated. The benefit of grading is that it's a third party ostensibly that determines the condition of the card, so that if you want to trade or purchase or sell a card with another party, that you have a way to come to some agreement of what the condition is, because condition is subjective. And especially if you're buying raw cards, so cards that haven't been graded at a card shop or a card show, often the seller of the card, well, it's in their best interest to misrepresent, or not even misrepresent, that's not fair, to exaggerate to the highest degree the condition of the card, or to give the most rosy scenario of what that condition is. And the seller has the exact opposite incentive, right? To say, well, yeah, I know you think this is a gem mint card, but I don't know. I see a little bit of off-centering here, so I think the value should be knocked down a little bit. It becomes really, really subjective, and in a lot of cases, that's where deals fall apart.
Well, and especially, just to give you another example, on eBay, when people put out the listing, then they'll put gem mint question mark at the end of their description, trying to say, oh, it could be gem mint. They're trying to get your mind into, oh, maybe I'm getting a really good deal on this card. So again, it's all subjective on this stuff.
And that's a fantastic point. And it made me think of another little pro tip for people that are just getting into buying cards. Very rarely can you buy cards on eBay that end up being gem mint. A lot of people that sell, especially that sell cards in higher volume on eBay, they know what they're doing. What they'll do is they'll buy a big lot of cards from somebody else, or they'll open up a bunch of boxes and they'll take the cards that they think have the best chance of getting that highest grade or gem mint status, and they'll ship those off to the card grading companies. And then the ones that they think, oh man, this is going to be maybe an 8 out of 10 or a 7 out of 10, I'll sell those raw or ungraded, because it's not going to be, there's not going to be enough value in the grading to cover the time and cost and expense to get that card graded. And the jerks that will mark as gem mint question mark.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, there are people in the hobby that do that. So as you're buying cards, again, we'll do probably another episode, just like with grading companies, on buying cards.
On buying. You want to look
really, really closely at the images and make sure that whoever's selling the card has good, clear images, so that you can get a great representation of those four key factors: the corners, the edges, the surface, and the centering.
Yeah, not saying you can't find some, you know, PSA 10 raw cards, but it's very far and few between. And if people are going to use that gem mint question mark thing, it drives me nuts, but they better have a really good in-depth detailed description, which 99% of them don't. They just throw that in there hoping someone bites. So it's annoying, but it is what it is.
We're on to kind of our next topic on cards, and it's how to protect the condition of, because you pull a card and unfortunately the condition can't improve. It can only get worse from there. And so there are best practices and ways that we want to protect these cards. And Troy's got some good thoughts on that.
Protecting your cards. This is the one thing when you come back into the hobby, or you were in the hobby as a kid, you probably didn't think about a lot. I don't know a lot of kids that thought about the protecting their cards. It was more just bring them to school, throw them in the backpack, do all that stuff. But actually, when you get back into the hobby, like us, you realize there's all these different ways you can protect the cards. So when we start talking about protecting cards, let's just first talk about the dimensions. Most sports cards today are 2.5 by 3.5 inches, or for our metric using friends, 6.4 centimeters by 8.9 centimeters. Pretty standard. Most cards are like that. Now, we obviously talked about the die cuts, which can have angular stuff. Mm-hmm. There's also some examples. Oh, in the hockey world, OPC, there is a insert. We can't get the right word. Insert. They're called tall boys. And they're what they sound like. They're tall, but they're kind of narrow. They're not as tall as a regular card. Well, actually, they do make some that are as tall as a regular card. But they're like mini cards. Think about them as like tobacco-sized cards in baseball. If you ever seen the Honus Wagner T206, kind of they're smaller.
Kind of throwback designs that they're trying to give pay homage to designs of years past.
Yeah, like many vintage cards. They were way more popular in the vintage days when they had to put cards into like cigarette packs for baseball. They have the smaller cards. So just think about that, you know, and again, they're mostly rectangles. And then again, another thing when you got to think about cards, so we got the shape and the size, but there's also a thickness component, and a kind of a term that you hear is points. You might hear 20 point, 50 point, 60 point. All that is referring to is the thickness of a card, and 1 point equals 0.001 inches or 0.025 millimeters. The most common type is 20 point. So that's just the most common thickness of a card. Obviously, you get patches like we talked earlier. Those can be a lot thicker, which at the end of the day kind of determines what you need for a storage perspective on sizing of things that we're going to talk about. All right, so the first step in protecting your cards, you've opened your pack. You have it. You have the card in front of you. You didn't mangle it when you took it out. First thing most people do is they have an item. It's called a penny sleeve. What these are, and you correct me if I'm wrong. I'm trying to think of a good term. They're kind of like very thin, plasticky, little tiny bags. It's almost what they kind of are. They're just little plastic holders, and they're very flexible, very thin. You can get a lot of them for cheap. That's kind of hence the term, the penny sleeve. And they are mainly there to protect the card's surface. They do offer a little protection on the corners and edges, but it's kind of the first barrier of protection for your card. So when you have these penny sleeves, obviously you want to make sure you have the right size for your card and especially the right thickness. Because if you have a thicker card and you have a standard penny sleeve, it's not going to fit in. Or it might be super tight and then you might ding your corners or do something to the card. So again, that's where that point size stuff comes into play. If you ever have questions on point size for cards, you can Google like a sports card point template. And there actually are templates where you can like put your card on top on the edge and it will show you what point size it is.
Yeah,
I use mine all the time. And if that description doesn't make right, just email or send us a message on Instagram and I'll send you the link. So again, that first thing is the penny sleeve. Now, here's where I was such a noob when I started putting things in penny sleeves. I was so bad because you got to slide them in the penny sleeve. And obviously, if you start watching these people, you can't just slide it in straight from the top. You kind of have to go at an angle and then put it in. I'm not going to sit here and explain it. You can look at YouTube videos that there's a lot of good tutorials on how to put a card into a penny sleeve. The one trick I do, and I still do it today, if it doesn't go in right away clean, I'll slice a top corner, just make a thin slice. And then when you angle the card in, it goes in a lot easier. It's hard for me to explain that without you seeing it, but you'll probably find it in some YouTube videos. But again, the first barrier is going to be that penny sleeve.
And practice on keep common base cards. Don't, your first card you put in a penny sleeve, don't have it be your $500 raw card. Because if you do it incorrectly, you can damage the card. It's a really, like Troy said, a really important piece of protection. And if you go to buy a card and it's not in a penny sleeve, or most people, they might not even buy it because the whole hobby really considers it a essential, I guess, element of protection.
Yeah, it's just that first kind of protection. So first is the penny sleeve. And now we're going to talk about the next kind of barrier usually. And these are called top loaders. And so where the penny sleeve is a little like flimsier plastic, top loaders have hard plastic edges around the sides and bottom that give your cards a lot more protection on the edges and just around the whole card because it's a lot harder. If it dings around, it's probably not going to do anything to the card because it's a hard little piece of plastic. Before you put a card into a top loader, you should always put it in a penny sleeve. I was trying to think if there's any reason you wouldn't put it in a penny sleeve, but
no,
you should always put it in a penny sleeve and then into the top loader. And that's just a really good way to add two layers of protection to your card.
Well, you can damage, especially if there is some damage to the top loader on the top of it where the card's inserted.
Yeah.
You can run the risk of damaging the surface of your card, like by scratching it. Or if there is something in the top loader, like a little tiny rock or some debris, you want to have that penny sleeve protection before you put in the top loader.
And kind of just like with the penny sleeve too, with the top loader, you'll slide it in from the top. You can angle it a little to help get it about, halfway. Once you get it halfway, I wouldn't like sit there and push it from the top then to push it down because you might end up bending the top or damaging the top of the card. Once you get it halfway in, then just kind of bang it on the table. I don't know what the right term, lightly bang it, and it will slide in down in there. That way you protect yourself from damaging the top by trying to push it in. Sometimes I get a little carried away and I do push it from the top, but I try not to. It's usually better to get it about halfway in and then kind of bang it on a table so it slides down.
Yeah, it's a little riskier if you try to push it in from the top.
So top loaders, we talked about, size of cards. Top loaders, the standard size is 35 point. They're going to be bigger than the card, obviously, and they're going to be bigger than the card in the penny sleeve, but they'll protect it. It'll be a I don't want to say like it's not loose and it's not super tight. It's just like the right fit for a standard card. You can get thicker top loaders and penny sleeves depending on the point size of your cards. And I think, Josh, I think the note says they can go up to 360 point. Is that the top we think there is for thickness? On
yeah, that's the top that I found. To me, the really important thing here that any collectors are getting into it will run into this is if you're putting a card into a top loader and it's just doesn't seem like it's fitting and it's hard to push it down in there, stop.
Yeah, stop.
It means that your top loader is too small and you're going to really risk damaging that card. It should be, like you said, this is really hard to describe sometimes, but the way that a fit should be is if a card's in the top loader and you turn it upside down, it definitely shouldn't fall out.
No.
It should remain in the top loader, but it shouldn't be so hard that you have to force it in there either. And that's like, I think where you have that sheet that maybe we'll put a link to that in the description trail of the podcast, that maybe that'd be a good idea that you can put your card and understand the thickness of it so you can match both the penny sleeve and the correct top loader size to it. It's super important to have that, you know.
Definitely.
It's like the three little bears, right? It has to be just right.
And just to let everyone know, they actually make top loaders like the size of posters if you really wanted a top loader that big. They're kind of funny looking. But all right, so now we got the penny sleeve and we got the top loader. So that's usually, like for me, that's most of what I have my more valuable stuff in is a penny sleeve and a top loader. There's also, we have the cousin of the top loader, and that's the card saver. Now, I do not use card savers a lot. There's one instance where I have in the past, and we'll get to that. But card savers are, I don't know, we call them the cousins of the top loader. They're kind of like top loaders, a little less flimsier and less rigid. But I believe they're taller, aren't they? For sure they're taller.
Well, they're more flimsy. You said less flimsy.
Sorry, more flimsy. Yeah, I meant they're flimsier. And they're a little bit bigger than your normal size top loader. And they usually have that like thick seam on the side and the bottom edges that provides a better edge than just like a penny sleeve alone. So they do help protect. And it's just a matter of preference. Some people use card savers. Some people use top loaders. And again, I'm trying to think the last time I actually put a card into a card saver, I think I was like freaking out because it was probably like my first graded submission I was sending in. Because obviously,
grading companies will want you to submit.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Because I think they're bigger. I think they actually cut them out. Also, another use case that a lot of, and I actually do a little bit of this, if you're selling a real low value card, like a $2 card, and you want to ship it via, and we'll get into selling later too, but like a standard envelope that goes through a mail sorter, having that decent amount of protection, but more flexibility in the holder, not as rigid as a top loader, helps those cards get through the mail sorter. And other people just from like you said, it's just objective. It's just what they prefer, but they are bigger and bulkier. And then they have a tab on the top of them too, that if you see like in card shops, and they want to use a cork board. These are great cards that they want
to use thumbtacks
and a cork board.
Yeah. And again, I use top loaders more than card savers. I like top loaders are smaller. They're easier to store. So in general, card savers are used more for sending into grading, which we'll get into in another show. So that's kind of the three-pronged approach. And then we got a couple items. So there's also a way to protect your cards is books and binders. It's probably the way we all stored our cards as kids. We all had our binder books. I remember just sitting and going through them, constantly putting my cards in, taking them out, moving them because I'd have them by teams and I had to move cards around to destroy them in the process. But they are the books and binders I wouldn't call the most effective protection. It's more you want to enjoy your cards easily. They're not hidden. They're in a book. You want to bring them out. My kids have like their hockey cards in binders, they like to look through them. I think
I wouldn't want to put a $10,000 card in a binder. No. Is what you're saying?
Yeah, it's really hard, and you notice like when you go back and you look at, you know, you open your book. It's really important to make sure that the pages themselves, they'll usually have 9 slots for cards. Make sure if you're going to put them in books and binders, to make sure the slot for a card is deep enough or big enough to push to get the card in there. because a lot of times the top will kind of hang out just a little bit, and that's how it gets damaged, because pages, you know, you smush around, you move them up and down. That's one of the things I noticed with the books and binders I had as a kid.
Well, and like you said,
the cards were sticking out.
Yeah, that is definitely an issue. And like you said, too, having binders just invites you to move cards around. And yeah, every time you take a card in and out of one of those page sleeves, you run the risk of damaging it. You're fingerprinting it, number one. And the corners, you know, going in and out of those pages are at high risk of being dented.
Yep. One other thing, let me know if one other option you could use, this would be a little overkill, is you could do one touches for everything if you really wanted to. And if you don't know what one touches are, they're like single cases for raw cards, and they're magnetized. You put them in there.
They're a lot more rigid than top loaders. A
lot more rigid. Some people like them, some people don't. Usually, I can't remember. Do a lot of people put them in penny sleeves and then the one touch?
I don't. I think only there's a large percentage that don't close well with penny sleeves.
Okay, yeah.
And so I think that's one of the drawbacks. The other one is that the card has to be perfectly in the indentation when you put the top on, so that you don't crimp or crease an edge or a corner when you connect the two pieces of the one touch. But they are much more rigid than a top loader. So if a breaker pulls a $5,000 card and they want to send it to whoever won that card in the break, you'll often see them put it in a one touch.
Yeah. So that's definitely the one touch option too. And then the final one on protecting, and this is kind of the old school version that people use when they didn't probably know very much better, was these, they're called screw down cases. Have you ever seen them? They're basically two hard pieces of plastic, and there's a screw either in the top or in the bottom or both. And they were, what they said, they were kind of screwed down, and the card was placed in between it.
They're super thick, right?
Yeah,
they could be like 2 inches on each side, like in a lot of either plastic or acrylic, I remember them being.
And they're very popular, obviously, in the past, 70s, 80s, 90s. A lot of them didn't include an indentation for the card inside of the panel, and they were screwed down super tightly, thinking they're protecting the card. But what did that do? It just damaged it, because it basically flattened it. Every card has a little thickness. If you look at the side, you can see a little bit. And if you flatten that thing, getting to a grading perspective, it's usually considered altered or damaged. And sometimes it usually doesn't work out well. If you have a card in a screw case and you want to send it in for grading, they did more damage, I think, than people thought they would do. And then also getting them out of the thing, out of the case, unscrewing it. Some of these cards are very fickle, and they might, kind of the surface of the card would stick to the plastic. You could have moisture that got into these, because if you're screwing at a top and bottom, it still might leave a little, it doesn't make a perfect seal. Obviously, some of the screw cases, I think, had 4-corner screws in them, but this is, the risk of damage on these is very high. If you do have cards in screw downs, I think the recommendation usually is just to get it out as soon as possible. But watch a YouTube video on how to get a card out of a screw down safely.
Or leave it.
Yeah, you know, or maybe just leave it.
Sometimes the risk is, and I can speak from personal experience, I had bought a big collection of multi-sport cards at one point, and included in that was an early 60s Harmon Killebrew baseball card that was in one of these screw downs, and we went to take it out. We literally peeled the card in half because the back was stuck to the back half of the screw down acrylic, and the top to the, it was just fused on there and obviously destroyed the card.
Yeah.
And I think another point around those that's really critical is if you're at a card show or you're looking on eBay or you're in a card shop, I would recommend not buying a card in a screw down. Because you don't know how long it's been there, and if it's screwed too tight, or what kind of damage, if it's been flattened and it's altered the dimensions of the card to get it into like a non-conformed size, it's really not worth the risk at that point. And then I think like the other good point you already made, Troy, is if you already have one of these and you want to maybe try to get it graded or get it out of the screw down and into a top loader, I would watch a whole bunch of videos and see if there's a safe way. I'm not even know if there is a safe way to do it. I'm not a good enough of an expert to make a solid recommendation there.
I would say, though, if it's a card you do not ever, you know, like you said in the past, if you don't plan to sell it, you just want it, and it looks good in a screw down, and it's cheaper maybe, then get it. I mean, if it's something you enjoy, if you're no plans ever taking it out or selling it, and you can get a deal on it, it might be a good reason then to buy it in a screw down. But generally, probably want to stay away from the screw downs.
Yeah, I wouldn't pay top dollar for it.
No.
Because I think you have to get a 30% discount or something like that. But yeah, good point.
All right. So that is how to protect your cards. Obviously, people, please let us know if there's anything we missed. I'm always interested about protecting and storing. So we did the protection part. Josh, do you have anything else you want to add on
protecting? No, I think you covered it all, Troy.
Okay. So now it's on to how do you store your cards. And boy, is this something I think, Josh, I've seen your office. I've seen your office. This is something you struggle with, I struggle with, we all struggle with. How do I store all this stuff?
Becomes this hobby is very addictive and you tend to accumulate.
Yep.
And, you know, you have seen my office, so that's why I'm not leading in this part of the discussion, because it can be a very fraudulent endeavor at that point.
And even like, it's very addicting, but it's also, it's one of those hobbies where you know you have cards that probably will never be worth anything. But there's that 0.001% chance that Pecorine base card might become very high in demand in the future. So you got to keep it. No, it's something we all struggle with. It's how do we store your cards? Obviously, we kind of talked. Some of the protection stuff is also kind of how you store them also. So if we said, if you have valuable cards, penny sleeve, top loader, or a card saver, get them in that. We're going to start there. So, and that helps protect them when you store them. Then you got to think about, are you storing for organization? Are you thinking about displaying your cards? How exactly, you know, certain cards will fit into different categories. And when we think about the organization piece, which is a part of, at the end of the day, how you're going to store your cards, starts with how you're going to organize them. There's more than a million. There's probably a million one ways for you to organize how you're going to store these things. It can be based on like your personality, the goals you're trying to achieve, how you personally want to manage your collection. You can do it just off the top of my head. You can do it by team. You can do it by player. You can do it by valuable cards, common cards, Hall of Famers, people with sweet hair. I mean, there's a million different ways you can store your card collection.
It's part of how you enjoy the hobby. Yeah. Really.
You can do sets. I'll just give an example, a recent example for me. I had all my cards stored in sets. I had them by set in boxes, which I'll get to later, or get to the boxes in a bit. But all of a sudden, I decided I don't like that. I want it by players. So I redid all my card boxes and storage, and I have them by player now. So that was, you know, a 2 to 3 week endeavor, and it's still not done because I'm actually forgetting about cards I have in other spots in our house, and I'm finding those and having to redo those. But so, yeah, it can change over time. It's just how your collecting habits change. So once you get it organized, now we got to figure out how to store it. There's a bunch of ways, different ways to store your stuff. I think the most obvious and people are used to or have seen are card boxes. You can get these online. They're big cardboard boxes, or they can be small cardboard boxes, depending on how many or how many cards you want to store in it. Beginning from 100 to 5,000 cards. Your local card shop, your LCS, will also have these. They are made specifically to store trading cards, or if you're into Pokemon, like trading game cards, this is what they're made for. They come in, obviously, different combinations. You can get them with different row lengths or, you know, row widths. If you want to put top-loaded cards in these, you can do it. If you want to get some that are for graded cards that have, they're in a slab, you can do that. That's one thing they did is they make an option usually for everything that you want. And again,
yeah. Another thing we kind of forgot, or we didn't have in our notes, but we should add, is when you said the graded cards, it made me think of there's this newer accessory that's become real popular, are like hard plastic cases for graded cards. Yes. That if you think of like how people store like camera equipment or drones, very similar concept, and they come in backpack formats or more case that you'll see at trade shows if people have their high value collection. Yep. a lot of times they'll be in one of these cases.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to make a note to revisit that in this section at the bottom, because that's a good point. There's actually another point I want to make on that. So our first storage option we said were card boxes. Okay. There's lots of them. You can find them. Lots of good options out there. The other another option we talked about, we already talked about it for protecting, was the binder or book route. Again, I don't want to rehash it. Obviously, it's you put them in the binder in the book. You want to look at them. You want to check out your cards. It's easy spot to do it. It has the drawbacks, but like we talked about with protection, they can get damaged. You're moving cards in and out of pages. It's just, it leads to more damage than having them stored in a box. But
yeah, the one thing I would add to the binders, Troy, is that especially in a lot of old collections that maybe have been in a dingy basement for years, going back to a lot of them, the tops are exposed.
Yep.
You'll see a lot of, whether it be like maybe water damage or mold even on some of those. So you got to be careful when you're looking at old collections that have binders.
For sure. Yeah, it's definitely a great point. So now the last kind of category we put down was card cases. So let's visit what Josh was talking about. There's companies that make these hard plastic cases that you can put graded cards in. Again, all different sizes. They also actually make backpacks if you want that. They actually now make backpacks with battery packs in them for you, like you charge your phone and carry your cards around. So that's definitely an option too when you're going to card shows. It's actually probably a really good option. And even if you only have one or two cards, graded cards, they actually make graded cases for one or two cards if that's all you're going to bring to a card show, or those hard protective cases. And then along with card cases, there's also you can have there's different kinds of display cases that fall into the card case realm. You can have wall-mounted cases, stand-up cases. Obviously, these are my favorite. I have three wall-mounted ones, and I love switching cards in and out and rearranging and putting them there. But to me, it's also like a piece of art on the wall. But it also protects and stores your card as well. Again,
yeah, the only thing I would say about that is, if you have it on a wall, just be careful where that it's not on a wall where a lot of natural sunlight comes in, because you can bleach and wreck a card that's getting too much direct sunlight
Actually, you can get these cases, they'll have a term, it'll say museum quality glass, which means it should reflect 99% of ultraviolet lights if that is something that might be an issue for you. They're really big in the comic book world, putting comic books in cases, because those things can bleach quick if you have them.
Oh, interesting.
But yeah, so that's the card case route. Any other ways to store your cards besides what we're going to get up next, which is kind of safety and preservation? Obviously, we talked about.
No.
Okay. So safety and preservation. Don't leave super valuable cards at home or lying around your house with easy access to someone for someone to take. Just be smart about it. And don't, if you have a super valuable card, don't sit there and advertise to the world where it's located at. You got to use some common sense, because there are people out there. And even if it's just like some random person you're letting into your house to do like furnace work and you start mentioning something, you just got to be smart about it. So that's the number one tip. If you're looking at safety and preservation, just be smart where you have them and don't announce it to the world. I would think fire safes are a very good option if you're not displaying them. If you have them in your house, you want something that will protect them in case of a fire or a flood or any of the stuff that can happen, the bad stuff that can happen that we hope never happens.
Basic protection on theft is a good, sometimes thieves can pick up a case or a safe and carry it out of your house. So it doesn't give you protection there, but in many cases you can screw those safes into the floor or do some, it's just a lot harder to take the card if it's just sitting on a desk versus in a safe.
Yeah, for sure. And then kind of the next step after the kind of the fire safety deposit box, if you want to go this route, is there's bank safety deposit box. That's still a thing. You can, if you have very valuable cards, you can take them to a bank, get a deposit box and throw them in there, and they'll put it in their vault and then it will be protected. Obviously, you'll have to pay some kind of monthly or yearly storage fee. So that's definitely another option. And then kind of the cousin to the bank vaulting, there's also vaulting services. We'll talk about it in a later episode. But just to give you an example, say like eBay has a vaulting service where you can send a card off to them. They'll put it in their vault, and now it's stored. And then I'm almost going to go off on a tangent on what you can do with it. But yes, there's companies that do this.
It's kind of wild to think about, though. Like, let's say you were one of the two people on Earth that had the 1979 Wayne Gretzky OPG rookie PSA 10. Yep. That's worth, what, $3.75 million? I'd be terrified to have that card even in my... You almost even couldn't enjoy it, right? I mean, I would lock that card in deep into a bank's vault or so far away where I was 100% assured of its safety that it does take, you know, and I think that's something you have to balance as a collector or an investor, is the more valuable these cards get, the more anxiety around having them that you kind of tend to have.
And I should say to always check on these vaulting services what their insurance policy is. Like, if how much are you protected? Is it to the full value of your card or what? Whatever. That's always something good to look at. If you do store your cards at home, obviously be aware of your, you know, the temperature, where they're stored, the moisture. You don't want mold. You don't want any of, you know, damp, humid areas where you're keeping your cards. Because even if they're in boxes, they can start sticking together, especially those like chrome cards. Yeah. Those can get sticky in the perfect environment. So you just got to watch those. Be cognizant of where you store them in your house, obviously with the environmental factors.
Mm-hmm.
And then last point I want to make on safety and preservation. If you have, I'm not an insurance agent, but if you have a big collect or you have a valuable collection, you are probably covered a little bit on your home insurance, but you might think about an umbrella policy or something else to cover the cards that might not be included in your homeowners. It's one of those things, talk to your insurance agent. But if you have a valuable collection, it's definitely probably a smart move in case something happens.
Yeah, if you had a $100,000 collection and you were just to assume that it was covered under your umbrella policy and your home gets robbed, that would be a really crappy way to find out that it's so. It's probably best to be proactive and talk to your insurance agent, because it's not only whether it's covered, it's what you have to supply to.
Yep,
like I think in some cases, or videos even in some cases, you want to make sure that you're up to snuff on all that.
Cool. All right. So we did protection and storage. I think we're good on that. Again, please let us know in comments if we missed anything. We'd love to hear other ideas that are out there.
So I think we've covered a lot in part two, actually, right? We just to recap, you know, our goal is to give any new collector or somebody thinking about collecting an introduction to cards themselves and how to determine and understand condition, protect your cards, how to store them. Like you said, I'm sure we've missed some things. We have the segment at the beginning of each of these special episodes. We'll continue to do it for episode three. So please message us if you think we've left out some critical information, and we'll be sure to include that. We are going to continue with the series. We will have part three. There is no set schedule to this, and I think we mentioned that last time. Our kind of loose goal is every couple of weeks, but this isn't our regular even podcast gig. We do have the Hockey Cards Gong Show podcast, which is a weekly show that we hope you'll check out as well. But if you have ideas for what would make sense to cover next in sort of our hopefully chronological journey to beginning card collecting, please feel free to message us on probably Facebook or Instagram would be the best places to do that. And if you are liking the series, you know, we'd love for you to leave a review on whatever podcast app you're listening to us on. So I think that's our show for this episode of Hockey Cards 101. Thank you all for listening. You can, if you are liking the series and you want to see more content, you want to see us grow and be able to produce more content and help the hobby grow, we are a Patreon podcast, and the link will be in the description of this podcast in your podcast app. We would, you don't have to, of course, but we would be grateful for anyone that decides to become a supporter of the Gong Show and support us that way. And of course, you can also follow us on all of our social accounts, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you soon for part 3 of Hockey Cards 101. Thank you.